Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050202, Energy Service Company of Bowie, Inc. versus Superior Snubbing Services, Inc. from Wise County in the 2nd Court of Appeals District. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in that cause. Docket number 031066, Arkoma Basin Exploration Company, Inc. and others versus FMF Associates, 1990A Limited and others from Rockwell County and the 5th Court of Appeals District. And 041004, Hoover Slovacek LLP versus John B. Walton Jr. from Winkler County and the 8th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in these matters, and the court will take a brief recess between each argument. We expect to conclude all arguments by noon today. The proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050202, Energy Service Company of Bowie, Inc. versus Superior Snubbing Services, Inc.
May it please the court, Mr. Greg Abe will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Greg Abe. I'm here on behalf of the petitioner, Energy Service of Bowie, Inc. In 1989, the legislature, at the behest of the oil and gas industry, chose to substantially revise the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act to allow for the enforcement or enforceability of indemnity provisions supported by insurance. At that time, the statute was codified as Article 2212B, is now Chapter 127, the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. That statutory framework has been followed with near religious fervor by the oil and gas industry in this state since its adoption, and it, in effect, expressly mandates mutual indemnity obligations must extend not only to the parties to the agreement, but to their contractors and their employees.
Why do you think it took so long to notice that the compact had changed?
Because I don't believe that any party realistically in this area ever thought that the purpose of the change to the compact was meant to be substantive. And in fact, we know from the legislative history that it was not intended to be, and ever tried to cross that bridge. As I believe the amicus brief well explains, Your Honor, this is a benefit that all contractors operating in the oil and gas industry benefit from. Not just companies like Service, but indeed Superior enjoys the same reciprocal benefit. And before this time, I don't believe anyone, it ever dawned on anyone that the legislature, in adopting its change in 1989 to the third-party liability portion of the compact, intended to preclude an employer from agreeing to a contract which inured to the benefit of a third party. Indeed, Justice Heck, why would the legislature do such a thing? It makes no sense at all. If number one, we know is
that's not the test.
That is correct, Your Honor. Of course, it is not. But in fact, if all rules or laws were held up solely to what makes sense to us, perhaps there would be very few laws, or they would be quite different than they are. But the fact of the matter is that I think when looking at the change to that statutory provision, it is necessary to ascertain what the legislature was trying to do, because there was a law in the books, and there was a recodification. And according to the limited legislative history that we have, that provision was in effect supposed to be the current law. And in fact, it makes sense that there wasn't supposed to be or it intended to be a substantive change to that law, which I think takes us to where I'd like to go next, and that is the context in which this supposed change to the compact occurred. According to the Court of Appeals and the respondent, Superior Snubbing, here, in the very same year, 1989, that the legislature chose to change the any indemnity statute and allow for reciprocal and unilateral indemnity provisions so long as they were supported by insurance. The legislature, in the next breath, chose to eviscerate that statute and make it such that the component of the statute which provides for mutual indemnity, which includes not just indemnity for parties to the contract, but to the contractors of the parties of the contract, i.e. third parties. It chose to turn around and eviscerate that very statute. That there is no legislative intent anywhere, not cited by the Court of Appeals, or actually, in fact, from the legislative sessions, either the original or the two emergency special sessions that eventually resulted in the reformation of the comp statute in 1989. The master service agreement that we're talking about here is the standard throughout the oil and gas industry. And it was forged in the very image of that safe harbor provision, which was adopted in 1989 to the anti-indemnity statute. So what's this really about? Well, it's about the allocation of risk scheme that was developed under that statute.
Is this master service agreement, you say it's standard, is it a form promulgated by any agency or is it just something that's
That is not in the record, Justice Green, and I believe that it is based upon a form. I cannot represent to the court that it is identical to some of the forms which are cited throughout the statute, but I would submit that the case law that has evolved in this area would support the suggestion that it is a form, if not by a third-party group. It is certainly one that is used. The language is almost identical in all the cases that have arisen under the anti-indemnity statute and that have wrestled with the issue of enforceability. And in fact, the two agreements which are in the record, the one entered into in 1991 between Mitchell, the operator, and my client, Energy Service, and the one entered in 1996 between the operator, Mitchell, and Superior Snubbing, are, for all intents and purposes, substantially identical. So, did the legislature intend to throw out the statute it passed in 89, essentially gut it? The answer, in our opinion, is clearly that it did not. And let's be candid. Would we have filed this petition and be pursuing this remedy if there was a practical, easy solution to fix this? To say, okay, so third-party beneficiaries don't work. All of you contractors out there that work for an operator, just start signing up contracts amongst yourself. Well, I think as some of the case law has discussed, the Ken Petroleum and the other cases which have followed it indicate, this is a very hazardous industry. It is a very complex enterprise. It involves literally dozens, if not hundreds, of contractors. Contracts which operators have sometimes on a statewide basis, multiple countywide basis, county, individual well basis, and these contractors don't have any idea about the other one's existence or operation or a means to find out about the existence or operation of another contractor at that facility. It simply is unworkable. And without the mutuality indemnity provision or context, there will be no indemnity in this context, as the amicus brief highlights, because then only the operator is going to be the entity which is obliged to indemnify everyone, and it surely is not going to bear that risk alone.
Well, what that means, though, is you pay for your own fault.
That is correct, Your Honor. We would revert to exactly the scheme which is Justice Brister's opinion, the en banc opinion out of the 14th District Court of 2002, the Chesapeake versus Neighbors decision analyzes. That's exactly what the legislature tried to do away with, to create a system, whether we think it's a good idea or not, one that allocates risk to the party who can best control it. And there's no question that the individual employer of an employee who's injured at a well site is in the best position, if not the only position, to control that risk.
But didn't the Workers' Compensation Act amendments put in there specific provisions about employer safety and hazardous employers and things of that nature to induce employers to pay attention to their employees and their safety practices?
Indeed it did, and it provided them with a immunity liability to ensure that it didn't face civil liability from the employer. But what it did not do, and in fact what the legislature intentionally did in the same act, in the same year, 1989, was create a system which is at the heart, which is the bedrock of the reciprocal and pass-through indemnity process, which are a procedure which exists in the oil and gas industry today, which is to allocate that risk. Again, whether we think it's a good idea or not isn't the issue, really. It's the issue of whether or not the legislature approved and allowed for this specific indemnity right to exist.
But there is a difference between the language of the statute originally that said that an employer is liable unless they have, prior to the injury, executed a contract assuming liability for injury to their employees, and the current language that says executed a contract with the third party. There is a difference in that language.
There absolutely is, Justice Johnson. There is no question about that. The language changed. But I don't believe the analysis ends there, and as I believe this court explained in the Kim Petroleum case, the analysis of what would the legislature meant in adopting that statute has to include why it made that change. And I submit that there's not only not any evidence in the legislative history to support that this was supposed to be a change, which, in my opinion, radically narrowed the scope of liability which could be assumed by an employer. And in fact, the legislative history that is available says it meant to be comport or continue on with current law. That's what we have in the legislative record. In absence of anything to support the interpretation given to it by the Court of Appeals, and authority to support the notion that there was not intended to be this substantive change which was read into the law.
But we've said even if they didn't intend it, if they made it, that's the end of it. So if this language did change things to the extent of the language, so that there now has to be an agreement with a third party, what is your best argument? What are your best arguments for why you still prevail in this case?
Well, I don't. While the statutory language, which is currently on the books regarding third party liability, says a contract with the party, it does not, in Energy's position or opinion, necessarily eliminate or expressly prohibit the notion that a third-party beneficiary could also be a part of that contract. And I think, Justice Heck, that it is not consistent with the tenets handed down by this court with respect to statutory construction to look only at the comp provision at issue. It is absolutely imperative to consider both statutes, that any indemnity provisions, the safe harbor provisions, which expressly contemplate mutual indemnity obligations extending to third parties and the comp code provision. I don't believe that a proper assessment of the issue here can be reached or conducted without considering both statutory provisions side by side. And I think when that is done and the statutory history, the legislative history behind those two statutes is considered, that it is reasonable to reach the conclusion that the legislature in 1989 meant to prohibit indemnity obligations being enforced by a third-party beneficiary, which the parties had specifically intended. The notion that there somehow is some type of surprise or undue hardship on a contractor is simply not accurate, and I would submit it's disingenuous. Number one, the status quo is that each employer in the oil field industry is responsible for indemnifying others for injuries to its employees. That is the current status quo. That is clear. That is not in dispute. And let's not forget that the fair notice doctrine is alive and well and still applies to these agreements. It really isn't consistent to say, well, it's got to pass the fair notice test, but at the same time, it surprised us. That indeed is the very genesis of the fair notice requirement, is that there is no surprise. And I would also point out that indeed, just as here, we're talking about an indemnity obligation which is only enforceable because it's supported by insurance. So we have a situation where the indemnitor had the foresight to get exactly the insurance required by the statute in order to make the indemnity obligation enforceable. In that situation, it's a non sequitur to suggest that that individual who's in the best position to control the risk of injury to that person and who got insurance to protect him or ensure that indemnity obligation is somehow surprised or suffers an undue burden simply doesn't hold water. It is, in fact, as the Texas Oil and Gas Association's amicus explained, it is the Court of Appeals decision which undoes the status quo and throws the current enforcement system into disarray. We ask the court to reverse the judgment of the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court's judgment.
Thank you, Counselor. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Lynn Fielder will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, the fact that it takes a little bit of energy and effort to comply with the law is not a reason for striking it down. And that's really what we're here about. Because the Texas oil and gas industry admits in its amicus brief that this case wouldn't be here and no other case like it would be here if they would just have all the contractors sign one agreement. But they don't want to do that. They want to use a master service agreement and be able to use it over a long period of time. But if they would just get everybody to sign one agreement, these statutes are easily reconciled, can easily be worked with, and there is no problem and no conflict to the extent.
Of course, the reason they don't want to do that is because they don't want to pay us, the lawyers, every time a well is drilled and 20 different companies are hired. Now, it would be better business for lawyers if we had to do that every time. Everybody hire a separate lawyer, negotiate this every separate time. But the fact of the matter is it's cheaper, ends up in cheaper gas for the consumers, et cetera, if we don't have lawyers fighting over the contract and every well and every subcontract, right?
Absolutely right. But I don't think that's a reason to strike a law down. I don't think the fact that it's easier or cheaper means that this court should abrogate the law. I'll grant you it's easier.
But you're saying, what you're proposing is saying, well, this will take care of it. Just do that in every case on every well and every subcontract.
That would be the way to comply with these statutes.
So no question, your proposal will end up in costing more.
I think it would. I think it would probably end up costing more. I think it would also be consistent with what this court has said repeatedly over the last 15 or 20 years about indemnity agreements. In Ethel, in Dresser, in all of those cases that talk about the need for notice.
No question, we look at them with great suspicion. But also no question, the legislature's carved out a specific exception for the oil field folks because the oil field folks had enough clout to go over there and get one, right?
They did, and the workers' compensation law has carved out a specific exception for subscribing employer.
Now, why is that not covered by the specific law overruling the general law? Obviously, the labor code applies to everybody in the world, and oil field indemnity only applies in one little industry, or big industry, but only one industry in any event. Why wouldn't the specific control over the general?
Because we don't have to get there. Because the Anti-Oil Field Indemnity Act specifically says of its own language that it doesn't affect any benefit conferred by the workers' compensation law. So we don't have to go to that other general principle. The Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act says on its face in plain language that the workers' compensation benefit is not taken away. And that's something I want to address because it was...
And that means the section of the labor code having to do with third-party indemnities?
That is our position, and I think that's a good position, and I'd like to explain why, because that was raised for the first time in the reply to the response, and we haven't even had a chance to respond to that yet. If benefit, in that context, only means benefits paid to a workers' compensation claimant, then the language of the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act talking about the benefit is meaningless. And this court has repeatedly said we will not construe a statute so as to make it meaningless. Because I can't think of any situation, under any circumstances, where an indemnity agreement between a subscribing employer and a third party would ever affect a claimant's right to workers' compensation benefits. So the only benefit that it could be talking about in the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act is going to be that benefit to the employer. And that benefit to the employer, in this case, is the right to have an indemnity agreement that is signed by the party who is seeking indemnity. That has to be the benefit it's talking about. And under the predecessor statute, it could have been talking about the fact that you couldn't have an ex post facto indemnity agreement.
So benefit wouldn't have the statutory meaning that is in the labor code. It would have a meaning, I mean, we would just have to say benefit in terms of...
I think it would have to, because otherwise the statute would have no meaning. Again, I can't think of any situation, and perhaps somebody else can, but I can't, where an indemnity agreement with an employer, a subscribing employer and a third party, or the lack of an indemnity agreement, would ever affect a claimant's right to benefits as that term is defined in the Workers' Compensation Act. That isn't going to happen. And so what benefit has to mean is a more global term, which would encompass...
But if Mr. Abe comes up with one in his rebuttal, he'll let us know by phone.
I will gladly submit a response brief to that, but I don't think he's going to be able to come up with one. He did come up with the argument, that I guess it's the first-in-time argument that he came up with, that is the predecessor statute obviously conferred no benefit on the employer, and I'm addressing that and have addressed that just a few minutes ago by saying, yeah, it did, because what it said is that you can't have an ex post facto indemnity agreement. This court has recognized that you can have indemnity obligations for existing or future liabilities. Well, under the old law, the predecessor statute, even that statute said, under the workers' compensation law, the indemnity obligation had to be signed before the loss. So I think that's what the term benefit means. And when the court looks at the term benefit with that meaning, the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act on its face says that the workers' compensation benefit to the employer is not affected by the Texas Oilfield Anti-Indemnity Act. Now, the public policy argument, I've read in the brief repeatedly about the devastation that there's going to be in the oil industry if this opinion is affirmed. And first off, as I've already said, I think it can easily be solved if they'll just sign one contract. But there is another devastation, I guess, that might occur if this opinion is reversed. And that is what's going to happen to workers' compensation in the oil field. What employer is going to want workers' compensation in the oil field if they're going to have an exposure to liability under indemnity from anybody and everybody who works on the oil rig? This court may take comp out of the oil field if you reverse this opinion.
Well, hadn't this been going on for years? Has that happened in the meantime?
I don't think, and I tend to actually agree with my opponent here, I'm not sure this is coming from anybody's radar. We couldn't find any cases on this issue here, and I'm not sure that employers or their attorneys maybe were really giving this a lot of thought, including
well,
this.
I mean, they're all looking at the bottom line. If they felt like that the comp benefit, the comp premiums they were paying wasn't doing them any good, they would have quit paying.
And that's what I have great fear will happen if this court writes an opinion that says that the Court of Appeals was wrong.
Looks like you would still want comp coverage for injuries that weren't caused by anybody else.
Well, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of benefit to that. I guess the argument could be made that there's some limited benefit, and that might take care of the very small injuries that don't require much. But I think
it seems to me if you're out there and you could sue your employer as well as third parties, that there would be quite an incentive to do that, wouldn't there? You don't think so?
To have comp?
To have comp to keep that from happening.
I think the nature of oil field injuries, and I think the Texas oil and gas industry refers to it in its brief, and I think Justice Bristol referred to it in an opinion that was written, these are usually devastating injuries. And they usually end up in lawsuits that involve other people and a lot of other parties. And that's when the employer gets sucked back into the case under what the petitioner wants this court to do. So what's the real point of having comp? Yeah, it may buy you some peace on small injuries, but on the catastrophic falling off the stabbing board, landing in the pipe rack kind of injuries, you're going to be right back in the case, and you're going to have exposure. And as an employer,
But you get insurance for that, too.
Well, and that's where I was going. As an employer, I would much rather have immunity than I would rely on the solvency of an insurance company or their coverage defenses that they might raise or the fact that there is a limit of liability. I mean, as an employer, I want absolute immunity. But that's not what you're getting if the court reverses this opinion. What you're getting is open season on the employer under an indemnity agreement, up to the amount of insurance and assuming that the insurance is good. So there's the public policy concern. What this court's being asked to do is make it easier on the Texas oil and gas industry so that they don't have to go out and get all the signatures on one agreement, and the trade-off may be a lot worse. The trade-off may be maybe not completely disappearing. I think that's an overstatement. I don't want to make that overstatement, but certainly a lot of people would opt out because there's no real incentive to have it.
Counsel, these things have been going on for a long time with these agreements and funding of insurance and all of that. I mean, in the Court of Appeals opinion, yours has changed that, has it not? I mean, because everybody's still buying insurance. This is really about insurance companies calculating their risk and their premiums for both the employer and the third parties under the Oilfield and Indemnity Act, is it not? Because we're talking about if you got comp insurance, you have an employer's liability section to the policy, don't you?
You have an employer's liability section of the policy for death.
Well, you have. Well, that's one of those exceptions you talked about may or
right.
may not come up. But you've got a carrier. You've got someone writing insurance for an employer. You've got somebody placing that. They look at the contractual liability indemnity, don't they, and go in there and underwrite that. Aren't we talking about insurance companies figuring out their premiums?
Well, as I understand it, the workers' comp policy will cover the subscribing employer for any injuries on the job. The coverage B coverage would cover it for death. The general liability policy has at least two exclusions that I can think of that would exclude it, and there usually is contractual liability coverage in a GL policy, which may not provide coverage. But
so that's what I'm saying. The carriers go in and they look at these liabilities on both the Oilfield Indemnity Act and the workers' comp, and they look at what their exposure is, and they charge the people for what their exposure is.
I think that's right.
Somebody's going to pay, whether it's liability policy or workers' comp with an employer's GL or whatever. We're talking about the carriers calculating their risk and exposure, and somebody's going to pay for an injured employee.
I agree with that. We're talking about a risk allocation scheme here. That's true. And our point about the risk allocation scheme is that the legislature, in about as plain a language as I think they could say it, has said that you're not going to get indemnity against a subscribing employer unless you're a signatory to that agreement.
All that means is all these subs out there that are not specifically contracted for have to buy liability policies to cover them for whatever they do wrong.
And I think that's what the Texas Oilfield and Gas Indemnity Act contemplates anyway, is that they will be insured. Right. This is a risk allocation situation, in truth, when you get right down to it, and it's a bunch of insurance companies arguing about who has to pay what, whether it's a contractual indemnity situation or whether it's a comp premium or whatever. I agree with that. But I think that the statute on its face is clear.
You say that if the Court of Appeals is incorrect, there would be severe consequences.
I think there would.
But those consequences existed before 89.
And I don't
from
think
from 1963 to 1989.
And for whatever reason this has happened, I don't know why this hasn't come up on the radar. But if I'm a lawyer in Texas and I read the opinion this court might write if it does favor the petitioner, I'm calling up my employer clients and I'm saying, do you really want workers' comp? And let's talk about that, because are you buying a pig and a poke? I mean, what are you getting for your money here? Because if you're in the oil field, you're going to get brought back in any big lawsuit anyway. You're going to get brought back in on your commitment and you're in the lawsuit. You're not buying immunity. You really want this. Comp is expensive, and if you're not getting immunity...
Well, isn't this an argument you make to the legislature? Why would we care even if that's true? Why does that matter? We as a court don't have to promote workers' comp. If it's more feasible to go elsewhere to be a non-subscriber, then that's okay.
I don't think it has to be dealt with by this court. I think this case can be dealt with real easily by this court by saying we read the statute, it means what it says, and we don't have to get off into legislative intent. We don't have to get off into public policy. It's the petitioners who have raised the public policy and screamed devastation and eradication and horrible things are going to happen. I think this is a very simple statutory construction case where you read the statute, it means what it says, it's plain, the legislature has spoken, and we move on from there and you affirm what the Court of Appeals did. But if we want to get wound up in public policy arguments, we can go there, and that's where we go down the road about what effect does this really have. Because if we go public policy, we're saying, okay, oil and gas folks, you don't have to go out and get every signatory on an agreement. We're not going to make you do that. And the trade-off is we may be taking comp out of the oil field. That's a real bad trade-off. But we don't have to go there. It's just if the court decides to go there, that's what I think needs to be considered. So I think this is a pretty plain statute. It can be construed by this court on its face, and the Court of Appeals' opinion can be affirmed. And it's not going to tear up the oil field industry like it has been predicted by the petitioner. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fielder. Ready for rebuttal.
May it please the Court. Section 006, which says that the anti-indemnity statute does not affect any comp benefits, doesn't do one thing to further the respondent's position here. In the first instance, that statute predated the 1989 statute, which is the basis for the Court of Appeals decision in this case, by four years. So the notion here is when the legislature adopted 127.006, it foresaw that in two regular sessions and two special sessions after this, that it would adopt a statute that would somehow be construed as a benefit to the employer, and that's what it wanted to protect, not supported by the legislative history. That construction also ignores the history of both the anti-indemnity safe harbor additions in 89, and it also ignores the change in 89 to the comp provision at issue, which indicates it's not intended as a substantive change. So,
do you agree, though, with the respondent that it's hard to think of an example of an indemnity agreement affecting an employee's benefits?
I'm sorry, just a second. Are you asking me if I agreed with the view of the respondent that you'll never need comp?
No, that it's hard to think of a way that an indemnity agreement could affect an employee's benefits.
Right. In the situation that I believe existed at the time the anti-indemnity statute was adopted, is the section, I believe, 002 of the statute indicates it was common for there to be joint enterprises and projects going on at the time. And I believe that the fear was is that, well, one employer will attempt to use the benefits, the comp benefits that another received from him and say, aha, he's been paid, so he can't sue me. Or conversely, if that third party gets sued, the employer says, well, then you don't get comp because we're in a joint enterprise and you just sue the other guy. And the idea is what goes on between, the fight that goes on between contractors, as talked about in the Chesapeake versus Neighbors situation, that we want to stop shouldn't affect the benefits that the injured employee gets. This dispute that the anti-indemnity statute's all about and its safe harbor provisions are all about shouldn't have anything to do with that individual worker who's receiving benefits. And again, benefits isn't some just generic idea under the comp statute. It is a defined term. It's convenient, I understand, for the respondents to ignore the statutory definition.
Can you respond to the public policy issue that if this court was to affirm the Court of Appeals, it would take the comp, essentially abolish comp in the oil field?
With all due respect, I think it's a silly argument.
What would be the effect?
I believe it would be nothing. I believe that employers would still have comp. Number one, they would get sued unquestionably for injuries to an employee at a well site. But the suggestion that
they generally get sued anyway in a CAT claim, right?
Well, an employer does not, but they get sued if they I think the term was open season used by the respondents on employers. No, it's not open season. The employer chose to enter into a contract that says I will indemnify third parties for my negligence or their negligence. No one declared open season on them. They contractually agreed to indemnify third parties. And number one, the comp benefit would protect them from claims against their insured in that context. But the key to that suggestion Justice Medina, is it that somewhere out there is the idea that the only time an employer gets sued is on a rig site or a drill site. Let's talk about the fence contractors, cement contractors, the guy that delivers the portalette, that cleans the portalettes out. The idea that the only work their employers do when they show up on a drill site is simply doesn't have anything to do with reality. Comp's not going anywhere. No one has suggested that, and there's no evidence of that. The fact of the matter is, employers would still have comp because they need the comp to protect themselves. We ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals opinion and affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All rise.